Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 163, the year 1845. New Cape Governor Sir Peregrine Maitland had shown he was a man of action. As a veteran of the Peninsula campaign against Napoleon, you'd expect that, particularly as he fought at the Battle of Waterloo. This new man of action, the governor, had some doubts about a few things here in sunny South Africa. He doubted the effectiveness of Andries Stockenstroom's Eastern Cape ceded territory system for a start. He would sort that out, he thought, with the introduction of a new system, which was actually an old system. More about that in a while. Maitland also doubted the effectiveness of two other treaties signed by his predecessor Sir George Napier with the Griqua leader Adam Cook III and King Mushreshwe I of the Basutu. But we need to turn south for this episode, back to the Eastern Cape frontier. The 1840s were a high point of settler power in the Eastern Cape, and wool was driving development. As the state expanded, pressure grew on the ceded territory between the Fish and Keiskamma rivers. It was also a time of reinforcing both the military forts around the frontier and the communication systems. Starting in the mid-1830s, the British had extended their forts and signalling systems across the Eastern Cape. They had been caught off guard by the Amakhosa, who'd raided the Eastern Cape without warning at the start of the Sixth Frontier War, and it was imperative they improve their communication. After the Frontier War of 1835-6, the planning of the system of frontier defences fell on the Royal Engineers, including Lieutenant Colonel Griffith George Lewis and Captain W.F.D. Gervois, as well as a civilian employee of the War Office called Henry Hall. Lewis commanded the Royal Engineers in the colony at the time. He repeatedly expressed his frustration at the tardiness of the British government in allocating funds for the effective defence of the frontier districts. These funds, of course, were squeezed out of the British taxpayer, so the political leadership will not always release investments of this sort immediately. Lewis was one of those folks we come across every now and again, someone who seems to understand the big picture and the need for action. He wrote extensively on frontier defence policy and complained that for years after the close of the previous war, no clear decisions had been taken on how funds were supposed to be used. His warnings, like those of Sir John Hare, the Lieutenant Governor of the Eastern Cape, were not being heeded. Gervois built the stockades at Peddy, Trompeters Drift, Double Drift, and Fort Brown, all found in the frontier districts of the Eastern Cape. Gervois, by the way, would end up in the Channel Islands, and designed and built a whole series of fortifications that were eventually to become famous during the Second World War. The Imperial Government approved of Lewis's scheme for signal towers and new roads and bridges to improve communications between these forts and the headquarters at Grahamstown, where new barracks were being built on the old Drosty ground. Lewis had been instrumental in building a series of towers to improve communications with Fort Beaufort and Fort Peddy, starting from Fort Selwyn in Grahamstown. The survey to establish suitable points on which to erect the stations was done by Henry Hall. These are amazing structures, stone-built towers 30 metres high, with one entrance to the first floor, and were provided with ladders which could be drawn up before the door was closed. A staircase inside led to the flat roof of the tower. If you made it up these stairs, you'd arrive at a mounted semaphore, a type of signalling mast first developed by Claude Chappe during the French Revolution. The mast was composed of a regulator pivoted at its centre, so it could rotate and also slide up and down. At either end of the regulator were indicator arms, which could be placed in seven different positions. In practice, only 196 combinations of positions were used, although many more were mathematically possible. The Fort Beaufort line of signal stations went from Governor's Kop to Graskop, Boeters Post, Dan's Hoogte, and Fort Beaufort. When the next war with the Khoza broke out in 1846, all the towers on this line had been completed and equipped with semaphore masts. These forts and towers had their limitations. Henry Hall found that the signals made to Fort Beaufort from Dan's Hoogte could not easily be read, although signals from Dan's Hoogte to Fort Beaufort could. The reasons were geography and underpowered lenses. Unless the towers were placed against the skyline, it was difficult and sometimes impossible to read what was going on. Furthermore, the telescopes supplied were not sufficiently powerful, so the signalling system was a little less than successful. Some at the time said signal towers were in fact of very little use, for the signals were difficult to decipher, the upkeep of the garrison's expensive and water supply at the towers was always a problem. Henry Hall later recorded, "Within 1 month of the outbreak of war, all these towers were in ruins, abandoned by us or burnt by the enemy." Before these towers had been built, there had been signalling in Table Bay and False Bay, but nothing as substantial as the Eastern Frontier semaphore system existed elsewhere in South Africa, and in fact, even throughout the British Empire. It was somewhat ironic that only in Britain itself was the signalling system as extensive as in the Cape. Even in the British Empire's jewel in the crown, India, there was no comparative comms system like this at the time. These towers were expensive to build and expensive to maintain. For example, the line of comms from Fort Selwyn in Grahamstown through Governor's Corp Tower, Graskop, Boetes Post, Danshoogte to Fort Beaufort, the other from Grahamstown through Governor's Corp Tower to Fraser's Camp, Piet Appel's Tower and Fort Peddy, cost £5,000. The cost of each tower, £500. Each was manned by a sergeant and five men. They'd need every bit of help because coming down the line was another frontier war against the Amaxhosa. Robert Godlinton had decided that his Grahamstown Journal was going to up the ante once more when it came to both the Cut River settlement, where the Khoi Khoi lived, and the ceded territory itself. Appropriating the language of civilization, Godlinton wrote in the journal that colonization would be then synonymous with civilization, and the natives, instead of being depressed or destroyed, would be raised from their wretched, grovelling condition and participate in all the advantages which civilized government is calculated to bestow. The fact that the Amaxhosa people did not regard themselves as in a grovelling condition was utterly ignored by Godlinton. By 1845, the British settlers had been living in the Eastern Cape frontier for a quarter of a century. It was the 25th anniversary, and they wanted more. Many viewed themselves as emissaries of God sent to civilize Africa, which in reality meant that they believed that God had imbued them with the advantages of these civilized ways, and therefore they had every right to make Africans work for them. This is where the sentiment of the English settlers and the fur trekkers correlated. By the 1840s, the Cape Colony's remaining Dutch or now Afrikaans-speaking elite had adopted the middle-class view of the colonial British and allied themselves with the more liberal English speakers as the way to recover their preeminence. And by liberal, I don't mean in terms of race relations, but rather in terms of lifestyle, more education, more power for individual citizens. This is very interesting. In the midst of all these folks who anointed themselves as saviors of Africa, a sense of militarization was developing simultaneously. Added to this fervour was the fact that Godlinton and other editors, such as Fairburn in Cape Town, demanded representative government in South Africa. They wanted to rule themselves as much as possible. The Cape Civil Service in these years was led by John Montagu, who shared the settlers' view of the Amaxhosa. Because Montagu had managed to pay off the debt accrued during the previous frontier war in less than 3 years, it had also greatly increased his standing in both the Cape and in the eyes of the British colonial authorities back in Britain. For the previous 40 years of British occupation of the Cape Colony, the guiding hand of Westminster had been compelled to appraise events in South Africa. And by the mid-1840s, they were looking at a situation that, in spite of all efforts to control and simplify events and issues, the region had transformed itself into something larger, more complex, and infinitely more confounding. Nothing seemed to make sense. All that the territory seemed to offer was the threat of being a perpetual and accumulated financial demand on the British Treasury and the Imperial Military War Chest. It was about now that the place that began to be called South Africa in a generic sense gave the impression of being in a constant crisis. The crisis escaped all attempts to bottle it within certain limits. It was about to grow into an unbottled nightmare for the British War Office. In September 1844, the man of action, Sir Peregrine Maitland, rescinded the Stockenstrom treaties with the Amaxhosa chiefs. Maitland wanted the ceded territory, the area which had been handed back to the Amaxhosa, to be re-inhabited by the settlers. This disputed part of the Eastern Cape frontier would once again descend into chaos, but this time with a different emphasis and urgency, for the finality of the ownership of the ceded territory represented actually the fate of two peoples, the colonists and the Amaxhosa. The land between the Fish and Keiskamme and the Amatolas and to the sea was disputed, so too a chunk of land further to the north. Bit by bit, Amaxhosa, former Chief Maxhoma's beloved lands, began to be chipped off and incorporated into the colony. This contested land included the Cut River settlement. For the Amaxhosa, one of the benefits of Stockenstrom's system was the restored occupancy of the ceded territory without fear of commandos. That time was now over. The commandos were coming back with Maitland's new order, searching for stolen and rustled settler cattle, seizing livestock, whether or not the Amaxhosa villages were directly involved in the nefarious activity. The width of this territory between the Kai and Kaiskamma rivers along the coast was only about 45 kilometers at its widest point. At some points, it was only 15 kilometers wide. From the sea to the furthest reaches inland, the distance was less than 100 kilometers. For the populous clans here, this area of frontier was vital. Out of the 70,000 Amaxhosa living between the Fish and Kai rivers in the mid-1840s, three quarters were densely settled in this narrow band of country on the eastern side of the ceded territory itself and south of the Amatola Mountains. And of course, they were hemmed in by the Indian Ocean to the east. The reason for this concentration is the same reason we have today, geography. Between the Kaiskamma River and the densely populated Natal, there was no part of the coastal shelf between the escarpment and the sea that could absorb a large influx of newcomers. This was going to remain the heart of the sub-Saharan narrative, and in many ways tragedy through until the last quarter of the 20th century. The conflict of population, viable existence, and tradition. The Amaxhosa, who still lived in their traditional villages, required huge tracts of land to sustain their lives. Ironically, so too did the traditional Boers. Seasonally rotating pastures for their herds, fertile slopes and the valleys for their crops, game hunting in the wilder thickets of the ravines. By the mid-1840s, all land which could support such a lifestyle had been taken up all the way to the Kai and beyond the Kai. The land was sown up by the Xaleka, the Amamtembu, and the Ampondo. It was true that beyond the Kai there existed open country below the snowy Basutu Mountains, but cattle could not live there in winter. It was kept as open ground so that the Amaxhosa and others nearby could hunt wild game that still lived on these slopes. There's a propensity these days to consider the Amaxhosa of this time as unhealthy, dying of disease without modern medicine. That, dear listener, is disinformation. Already in the 1840s, Amaxhosa children composed nearly half the population, sustained by tens of thousands of head of cattle in a lifestyle that was outdoor in a climate that was one of the best on planet Earth. This area of the ceded territory could not sustain population growth, and even this early in our history, the land had appeared to reach its limit for sustaining a traditional Amaxhosa society, which was registering a rapid rise in population. The limited range of these seasonal pastures and the recurring droughts increased the burden on the land. As you know by now, wool was the main export of the Eastern Cape. And by this period of the mid-1840s, Port Elizabeth accounted for 47% of the value of exports from the entire Cape Colony. For the Amaxhosa and the Khoi Khoi of the Cut River settlement, a difficult future awaited. The Amaxhosa chiefs were aware that the increased reports of cattle theft and colonial clamour about these thefts represented a dangerous threat to their land. Lieutenant Colonel John Hare, who commanded the troops in the Eastern Cape, moved his troops into the ceded territory at the end of 1844 when Maitland dropped the Stockenstrom system. Hare did this under duress, as you're going to hear in a few minutes. Governor Maitland had a fundamental effect on this mix of geography, cultural practice, and economics. He was a military disciplinarian and steeped in the British Army tradition. He wanted action, and he wanted it now. When he arrived in South Africa, Maitland had viewed the evangelization of the Amaxhosa as a solution to the challenges, but now that he'd spent time on the ground, he'd changed his mind. The British colonial authorities had deployed their Peninsular War veterans as peacetime administrators at the Cape for decades. They believed that these military men and their determined forceful action would successfully deal with the Amaxhosa, like they were doing to the indigenous people in Canada and Australia and New Zealand. Maitland had been appointed Lieutenant Governor of Upper Canada and believed the divide-and-rule techniques that appeared to work there would work in the Eastern Cape, as well as across the Orange River. When Hare re-established military occupation of the ceded territory, he decided to construct a fort right in the middle of the disputed territory. Just a little ironic aside, Hare, of course, gave his name to Fort Hare, where in the next century, Nelson Mandela and other anti-apartheid leaders would study. Unfortunately, the first fort he built in the middle of this territory was at a site that lacked water. Hare needed another site, and fast. Charles Lennox Stretch, the administrator of this territory, was asked to approach new Amakhosa chief Sandile for permission to find the second site. During Stockenstrom's time, the colony had never built forts in the territory, even though they had the right, according to this treaty, after the last frontier war. Still, it was good manners to ask the Amakhosa chief. What happened next was so jaw-dropping, writing about it makes me shake my head. Instead of lining up a site inside the ceded territory, Hare, for some inexplicable reason, eyed a place east of the ceded territory, well inside Sandile's and the Amakhosa's land, a place that was definitely not part of the ceded territory. Why would the British do something so indescribably confrontational? This has applied the minds of many historians. I'll explain why this was a provocation. In mid-January 1846, a small squad comprised of a British officer and three sappers, or engineers, crossed over from the west bank of the Kaiskamma River to the east bank. Let me be clear, they had no right to be here, but appeared blissfully unaware of the danger they were in. These four pitched their tents and began surveying the site for a fort. No consent had been asked, although later it would emerge they planned to do so only after they were sure that this site was the ideal spot for their fort. They were being monitored by Amakhosa warriors. These Amakhosa youths, these young men, were constantly complaining that the English were stealing their land, while their chiefs like Sandile were trying to pacify the young Turks. The English administrators knew this. On the other side, the settlers like Godlinton were calling for more land to be seized for farming, while the English administrators tried to soothe their aching egos. It was from this date, mid-January 1846, that the frontier declined rapidly towards a disaster many anticipated, and some on both sides were actively egging on. Missionary Henry Calderwood immediately realized the squad of sappers was a very bad idea. On the 18th of January, he wrote to Dr. John Phillip, the head of the London Missionary Society in Cape Town, begging him to intervene urgently. "The feeling is deep and bitter in the extreme," Calderwood warned about the Amakhosa sentiment. "The feelings of the nation seem now to be against all white men." Calderwood wrote that the government had no power to send engineers to survey for a post on the east bank of this river. "The blacks are so sensitive on this point that they cannot and will not consider any question calmly when that is mixed up with it." The question of land, he meant. "The land question is a powerful engine by which the war party can work upon the feelings of the more peaceably inclined." Why Calderwood's letter is so incredibly prescient was that he was a conservative who supported the idea of the Khoza being ruled by the colonials. And yet even he was sounding the alarm at this brazen trespass. This letter could be regarded as one of the most reasoned and logical, the most succinct summary at mid-century of the situation between white and black on the frontier. Former Khoza chief Makoma hated Calderwood. But now these implacable enemies were actually singing the same song. Calderwood met with Makoma, who said the rains were late, his people faced a drought. He was also thinking of trying to move away because the next war appeared inevitable. The older generations of chiefs began to prepare for this war while warning their younger brethren that flirting with conflict would bring ruin to all. Makoma's half-brother Sandile was the official king in charge of the Amararabi line. Installed as the ruler on the 20th of July 1840, in front of thousands of his people and saluted by a volley from 3,000 muskets. Makoma had ruled the nation on Sandile's behalf until he was old enough, but never fully accepted Sandile's rule, partly because the new king was disabled. He had a withered leg. Sandile was grappling with modernity, but Makoma resented Sandile's rise to power and proved to be a handful for the youngster. First, Makoma set up Sandile's mother, Sutu, accusing her of being responsible for Tiali's death through witchcraft, one of the uncles. He also tried to blame Sutu for Ngqika's death years ago in 1829, sure that in the upcoming uproar he would take control of the Amararabi line once more. Cape officials, including John Hare, intervened partly because they thought Sandile was a more pliable tool, but also because Makoma was apparently intent on destabilizing the entire Amakhosa political system. The limping King Sandile was fully aware that he lacked a chiefly presence, and that many of his own subjects held him in low regard because he'd spent years growing up under Maqoma's shadow. Another talking point were the Amamfengu, the refugees from inland who'd streamed into the Eastern Cape. Most Amaxhosa in the ceded territories opposed the Amamfengu settlements that then-Governor Durban had established. What is being called a low-grade conflict was already underway, with the Amaxhosa raiding the Amamfengu repeatedly. Patu, other Amakunukwebe who'd fought on the British side in the previous frontier war and initially welcomed Amamfengu into his domain, then fell out violently with them. The British political agents living amongst these people didn't help either. They tended to increase discord by their erratic interventions in disputes between these various chiefs. Maitland, though, thought he'd managed to subdue these chiefs when he made them sign a new treaty in late 1844 at Fort Pedi. The Mhlambe, Kunukwebe and Mbalu leaders were all present, and just to make the point of how his power was supreme, Maitland deliberately did not invite Sandile, Maqoma, and the chiefs of the Amanqika line to the ceremony. A month after the initial signing, he summoned them to Fort Beaufort. When the Amanqika chiefs arrived, they were met by the 7th Regiment of the Dragoon Guards sitting on their large cavalry horses. This was a truly intimidating sight. 400 men holding their gleaming sabres in the air. The Amanqika got the message and assented to the new Maitland Treaty. What this meant is that settlers were now permitted to cross the border into the ceded territories to search for missing livestock or insist on compensation or both. The old reprisal system was back in full swing. It was the root of the violence on the frontier, warned Stockenstrom. For the Amaxhosa chiefs who tried to enforce the Stockenstrom system to avoid war over the previous 8 years, imperfectly it must be said, this new order was not acceptable. One of the first to realize the gravity of the blunder was Sir John Hare. He knew trouble lay ahead and offered his resignation as Lieutenant Governor of the Eastern Cape in protest. Maitland refused to accept the resignation. However, a year later, as the frontier exploded in flames, he would accept Hare's letter of resignation and then use Hare as a scapegoat. War was coming once more, as Hare and the Amaxhosa chiefs feared. It would become known as the 7th Cape Frontier War, or, depending on your politics, the War of the Axe, and for some, the War of the Boundary. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms that helps elevate its visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load a little update about this episode. You can contact me from there too. Until next, Salagatli.